Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and I'm actually part of a species of pinniped that is endemic to the region of the man-made lake called White Rock Lake in Dallas, Texas. I am the only pinniped species native to inland Texas, so.
Wow, I'm honored to be here with you.
Thank you.
I'm Violet.
Arf, arf.
My pronouns are she. I'm Violet. My pronouns are she, her. I have ADHD, and I am known to generate a charge when under stress.
So today we're doing mini dumps.
Little baby ones.
Little baby dumps.
Little tiny baby dumps.
If you haven't joined us for a mini dump is where Violet has two topics and I have two topics, and they're both very interesting topics I have, but the amount of information that those topics sort of contain is maybe not something I'd want to spend a whole episode on, or maybe not enough for a whole episode, but still worth bringing up. So Violet and I will be treating you to a little charcuterie board of topics today. And in the spirit of sharks, or lack thereof, I think I want to go first because I have a topic I think you're really going to like.
That sounds good.
So remember how you had the episode where you talked about the most remote places, most remote land masses?
Yeah. The most remote places you could go to, really. Well,
are they?
Theoretically go to.
No. I'm saying, what if there was an equally remote place you could go to that maybe you didn't cover?
Oh, have I been one-upped?
Perchance. I didn't look at the exact distance on the places you gave, but I'm going to talk to you today about Point Nemo.
Oh, about the journey the little fish went on and their point.
More like the thing that's named after the captain from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh.
So at some point in 1992... the question was posited, if you wanted to drop someone in the ocean and make them have to swim back to some kind of shore, some kind of landmass, what is the most remote place in the ocean where you could drop them, where they would have the farthest to travel before they reached land?
Oh, I see. So I was thinking most remote landmass, and you're
this is most remote actually, spot in the ocean.
Yeah, most remote from a landmass.
I did a Nuno reverse on you.
That's pretty
cool. I put my thing down, I flipped it and reversed it.
So, and went sicko mode.
The area of the ocean that is farthest away from any landmass and is located in the South Pacific is colloquially named Point Nemo. And like I said before, it is named after the captain from Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But the formal name...
Gotcha.
Is the oceanic point of inaccessibility.
Oh, interesting.
It is 2,688 kilometers away from the nearest landmass. Ducey Island to the north, which the name is funny, but Ducey Island to the north. Motunui, which is one of the Easter Islands, to the northeast. And Mar Island, part of Antarctica, to the south.
Okay, wow. Pretty distant stuff already.
These coordinates were calculated by a survey engineer who, God help me, I'm going to try to get this name right, Hrvoj, H-R-V-O-J-E.
H-R-V?
O-J-E. Hrvoj Lukatela.
Wow, what a name.
Excellent name. I'm probably butchering it. This survey engineer, Hrvoj Lukatela, in 1992, using a geospatial computer program that incorporated the curvature of the Earth into its calculations, used that to find the furthest point from land.
Very cool.
So Lukatela faced some kind of uncertainties in his calculations because he wasn't actually going to these places himself to get exact measurements. Like, how do you actually determine where the edge of a landmass is?
Yeah, that's a really tough one because tides rise and lower and it changes the edge a lot. Yeah.
So fortunately, since the closest islands to Point Nemo were pretty small, it didn't affect his calculations a massive amount. Lukatela even suggested visiting each of these islands to determine their vertices but that just would have been untenable because they're all pretty remote places in the first place. And to have to travel to all of those to go do that would be just, it would quite literally be a fucking expedition to go do that.
Yeah.
And Lucatello was like, I'll get you the closest I can with my pewter.
Yeah. What year was this that he did this?
1992.
1992. Oh, the year I was born.
And I was a little toddler. I was toddling around. So
you probably helped, I'm guessing, just when you were a little baby.
It's sweet to think that I helped in any sort of calculations at any age for calculating anything with my dyscalculia.
Just by being there.
I need the pewter to help me roll dice fast enough to play D&D without annoying everyone. But anyway, so accounting for the possible discrepancies in his calculations, Lucatello has three different sets of coordinates for this most distant point, but they're only roughly 10 nautical miles apart. There's one point where he's like, I consider this point Nemo, but adjusting for flaws in my calculations, here are two other points nearby it that could possibly be it if I didn't calculate the edge of these land masses correctly. What's really interesting is because of its remote location, this area is where many satellites and space stations have met their demise. It is a spaceship graveyard.
That's cool. So if you were to go swimming at Point Nemo and you were like able to dive down to the bottom, you'd probably see a whole bunch of cool spaceship stuff.
Quite literally the Mir space station.
Hell yeah.
So Point Nemo is located in something called the South Pacific Gyre, which is a huge system of rotating ocean currents that affects the water temperature and nutrient distribution. So this means the seas and the weather are also pretty fucked up around Point Nemo. So it is treacherous to get there. So the nutrient distribution thing is very interesting. Because of its location and its remoteness from other land masses, it's believed, and so far none has been found, that there isn't any marine life around Point Nemo.
That's kind of spooky.
Marine life benefit from the nutrient runoff from land masses.
Yeah.
And between its remoteness from other land masses in the South Pacific Gyre, there simply aren't enough nutrients in these waters for even really tough, hardy species to survive. From what I found, the most they found is some plankton.
Wow. Imagine like going out there on an expedition and you're going down in your little diving bell to get like water samples or whatever, and you see a creature swimming around. Oh man.
That would be
freaky. Exactly.
So the ocean floor at Point Nemo is about 4,000 meters down. So
okay, that's pretty deep.
I found a website that you might be very interested in called inaccessibility.net.
Oh.
And it is full of these accounts of people's expeditions to some of the most remote places on their respective continents or in the ocean and stuff. So if you're interested, if you're on Patreon, I've shared in my notes on inaccessibility.net, there's someone's account of reaching Point Nemo and getting in the water there to go head to Point Nemo and all of the stuff they had to think of. Because it gets so close to the Antarctic too, like the water's really cold. They needed a boat that could also handle like possible ice. It had a pretty high ice rating. They needed all sorts of stuff because when you get out there, there's nothing.
I bet you could sip on that water. I know it's probably it's salt water, sure. But
oh, it's salt water.
Sure, you're going to get sea madness. But hear me out. Hear me out.
No,
me out.
I don't want
You put some flavors in there?
No.
You got to imagine Point Nemo soup.
I don't want Point Nemo soup.
Boil some pasta in that water? Ooh, baby.
It might be some real delicious pastards, but I ain't gonna
There's
do
no
it.
Fish poop. There's no fish poop. There's maybe plankton, maybe. Maybe.
Whatever is leaching off of the space stations and satellites and whatnot.
Oh, well.
Whatever.
Well, yeah, there's that.
Whatever they had on the space station doing their secret space experiments, they didn't take down with them.
Just a shitload of tang.
So much fucking tang, you wouldn't believe.
Way too much tang.
Probably some tardigrades, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. Some little guys. I don't know for sure. But yeah, Point Nemo, it is the most remote area in the ocean.
That's sick as hell. I want to go there and drink the water and swim in it.
I swim, maybe. Drink the water.
Just a sip. I just want to see what Point Nemo tastes like.
Ocean.
I know, but it's going to taste different because there's no fish poop or stuff in it.
I don't know about that.
No seaweed, no fish poop. There's nothing.
Okay.
I'm just curious. It's like probably like the most pure seawater there is, I'm guessing. I don't know.
In the account on inaccessibility.net, the guy writing it did comment on how he was surprised just how blue it was because he expected for that depth and to have nothing there for it to be really dark. But he said it was actually like a really like sapphire blue color.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I don't really get like thalassophobia very easily, fear of big bodies of water. So I would love to just dunk out in the water there.
I absolutely would dunk out in the water there. I don't want to drink it though. And that's where you lose me.
Okay. I'll just take a little sip. I just want to see. What if I took a sip and I was like, oh, it's Kool-Aid. Oh my God.
You take a sip and it is the beginning to an episode of X-Files where a woman absolutely went unhinged after an expedition to Point Nemo. She spoke as if possessed by the devil. She drank the water.
She was possessed by a Tasmanian devil.
There was something on one of those space stations. You would accidentally drink that black goo from X-Files.
Oh my God, you're right.
That's what would happen.
Oh, wow, I would. Yeah, you're right.
But,
damn, you called it.
All right, that's Point Nemo. What do you got for me?
My thing is just kind of like, I went down a rabbit hole of, so I learned recently that cowboys and samurai existed at the same time in history.
Yes, I do know this. And I also learned that the fax machine was invented at a time where a samurai could have interfaced with a fax machine at some point.
It is certainly possible. Yeah, that's exactly the vein of stuff that I'm talking about today. Cowboys and Mexican vaqueros were prevalent from the early 1500s all the way through the early 1900s until, you know, like we get into Industrial Revolution kind of stuff. The samurai, or specifically referring to like an organized group of shinobi, because there were samurai before like the 15th century back to like the 8th century, but traditionally like the group of samurai is serving like a feudal lord that started in like the 15th century. Same as where cowboys started, roughly. The Victorian era spans the 63 years of Queen Victoria's reign over Great Britain and Ireland from 1837 until she died in 1901. Pirates and privateers were primarily active from the 16th to the 18th century. And I did have to look this up. A privateer is a specific type of legal pirate authorized by the government to attack foreign ships.
Oh.
Which is interesting. Yeah.
Interesting. I don't like
it's
them.
Like, yeah, it's like a pirate, but not cool.
Like a
like
government,
a pirate for the
a
government
security contractor who does the horrible things. We've
your
had
dog
them.
The bounty hunter.
Yeah, no, yeah, that sucks.
So also in the 17th century, the musketeers were highly visible, elite, and romanticized soldiers, particularly the French royal musketeers who served as the personal bodyguards to the king, a la the Three Musketeers and that whole story.
So your whole topic is weird things that overlap, just to solidify this for everyone.
Oh, yeah. And exactly. It's all going to wrap up here in the end when I have a proposed like scenario, basically. The 17th century, we also had cowboys. We also had samurai. We also had Victorian era people. Or not quite. We didn't have Victorian era people just yet. But we had musketeers starting in the 17th century. They served as personal bodyguards to the king, and their peak fame and activity were in the 17th century. But there were many musketeers still alive and some of whom still working in the early 18th century. Michelangelo, this is going to be a bit way back here, lived from 1475 to 1564. He was painting the Sistine Chapel in 1512 during the Sengoku era of Japan when samurai were prevalent.
Interesting.
That feels weird, right?
Yeah, he painting dicks while samurai were hanging around.
Yeah. Johann Sebastian Bach, who lived from 1685 to 1750, could have absolutely composed a cowboy ballad if he'd had the chance to make it overseas, or could have composed a theme song for the Three Musketeers.
Him doing cowboy music sounds pretty cool.
Right? It would be sick as hell. Vincent van Gogh was painting Starry Night while Wyatt Earp was still a lawman and a gambler in the West. He could have attended Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Jane Austen could have absolutely included the Three Musketeers in the Pride and Prejudice, and it wouldn't be chronologically out of place. It would have been better.
Just three more men for Elizabeth to be like, oh, I don't get it.
Yeah, but they have swords, so it's cool.
She wouldn't be into it. She needs an older main man.
Here's one of the wildest things. Oxford College was established in 1096.
Because of the linguistics, I do know this because they make the only dictionary that matters.
They've been around long enough. They might.
Yeah,
they
make the only
that.
Dictionary that fucking matters.
Oxford College was established 60 years before Genghis Khan was a twinkle in his father's eye.
Wow.
Right? That's fucking wild, right? Before he was even born.
You know, Bill and Ted has really ruined me for a lot of historical figures because you say Genghis Khan and I'm just like, from Bill and Ted.
Yeah, from Bill and
from
Ted.
From Bill and Ted, right? Yeah.
The modern circus, as we know it, that format of like clowns and tightrope walkers and trapeze artists was established in the late 18th century. So in 1865, let me say that again because I said it really weird.
1865.
I said it really weird. I tried to find all of these things that were like interesting events and people and things. I tried to see what could I find as the date where most of these things converge in an interesting way. And that date appears to be, as far as I can tell, 1865. Because in 1865, it is within the realm of possibility that a samurai, a cowboy, a Chinese pirate, a Victorian gentleman detective a la Sherlock Holmes, a circus clown, Vincent van Gogh, Karl Marx, Thomas Edison, Charles Dickens, and Harriet Tubman all could have met at Oxford College to discuss Abraham Lincoln's assassination, which had just happened that year, alongside the invention of the Gatling gun, or even the ratification of the 13th Amendment.
Interesting. So this would have to be also sometime, if the cowboy is going to be present, because I just had to double check my dates.
Yeah.
You said 1865?
Mm-hmm.
So it would
Yeah, the cowboys were still kicking all the way through the early
1900s. But I do think those cowboys would have been fighting in the Civil War, which ended on April 9th, 1865. So you could even narrow this time down even smaller.
Oh, yeah.
To be like...
Abraham Lincoln was murdered in April 11th, I think.
Yeah. So just saying, you know...
Like in April.
Yeah.
Probably.
So late April onward, this could have happened.
Yeah. There's like a date, like late April, like... My birthday, April 17th.
However
almost,
long
perhaps.
It would take the cowboy to make it to Oxford.
We're not worrying
okay,
about that in
okay,
this fiction.
Okay. Well, still, it, you could even narrow it down.
There's a realm of possibility.
In these
they
several
all existed
few
at
months,
the same time.
And they could all use a fax machine.
They could all use a fax machine. Isn't that fun?
And eat mummies.
They all just needed to fax each other. Yeah.
Yeah,
they could have all eaten mummies
because
that was
wild
the new
about
thing
that.
At the time. Right? Imagine a circus clown just feasting on a mummy right next to a samurai.
I know it's October, but that's too spooky.
Too spooky.
A circus clown feasting on a mummy?
That's too wild.
Too wild.
Yeah, I just thought it was wild how many things chronologically that we associate with like, oh, that's a different time period. They actually converge quite a bit. But yeah, that was my first thing.
Well, it's a wet one today. Both of my...
Tell me about it.
Both of my things are soggy.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Lake Baikal?
I am not familiar with Lake Baikal. Can I drink it?
It would be safer, I think, than drinking the water at Point Nemo.
Okay. Cool.
I wouldn't personally... Yet again, I don't know why your first reaction to, I've introduced you to a lake, can I drink it?
I think I'm just thirsty.
I think you probably are a dehydrated bitch.
Yeah.
Lake Baikal is the oldest and deepest lake in the world. It is
Hell yeah. It is
located in southeast Siberia. It is 25 million years old.
Damn.
And it's 1,700 meters deep. It is so deep, it contains 20% of the world's unfrozen freshwater reserve.
20%
of the world.
That's crazy.
The volume.
That's crazy.
The volume of Lake Baikal is greater than all five of the Great Lakes combined.
Well, that kind of puts the Great Lakes to shame a little bit, doesn't it?
I mean, listen, I only got to experience them for the first time last April since we moved, and they're pretty fucking massive. But this thing...
That's true.
While those are wide, this shit's just so fucking deep. This shit's big. Sure, it is very big, but it's deep as hell. So
that's
because
wild.
Of its depth and a few other things that I'm going to explain here, it's kind of got a spooky vibe. There's a lot of stuff that's in Lake Baikal that is nowhere else in the world. The area where it's located is where the tectonic plates are kind of slowly splitting Asia apart. So, like, there's some point in the future where Baikal could very well be the beginnings of a future ocean. But because of its unique location, the area is also prone to some pretty devastating earthquakes. But the geology...
That's interesting.
Yeah, but the geology of the region is also why the surrounding areas include hot springs.
Oh, fun.
So it is also located in this, like, structural hollow created by the surrounding mountains. Because of the sheer surface area of the water, the Lake Baikal area has a much milder climate than the rest of the areas of Siberia surrounding it.
Imagine dropping your phone in the middle of the lake.
Oh, it's gone. It's gone forever.
It's gone. Gone forever.
That shit's gone. And very literal, very little mineral content too, which also makes the wildlife very odd. It is freshwater, and the water is so clear you can see about 130 feet down from the surface.
Whoa. So you'd have a minute to try and get your phone.
You'd have a little bit.
You'd be able to watch it go.
You'd be able to see it go for quite a while.
Wow.
So because of how old it is, and because of how isolated it is, this is Siberia, right? Like, it's obviously people live there, but it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So there was some mining and stuff that was done around it for a while. People were dumping waste into it for a while. But they kind of worked at conserving it pretty hardcore from what I saw, like, in the 90s, because it is such a unique place that because it's got a ton of cool fresh water, it's really old, it's isolated. There is so much, both flora and fauna, there that is only present there. So it's colloquially known as the Galapagos of Russia, because of how much rich, unique biodiversity it hosts.
That's so cool. You know there's a big-ass cryptid in the lake, right?
I might do this one later, but there's apparently some fish or something that if you try to bring it out of the water, the old wives' tale is that your hand will melt off.
At Lake Baikal?
Yeah. I just touched the tip of the iceberg on that one, and I'm like, I'm going to come back to that later because you're probably going to be in a cryptid.
Well, don't do that. Your hand will fall off.
I know, true. But about 80% of the species who live there are endemic to Lake Baikal. 80% of all the fishies and plants there are just like, just live here.
That's wild. I bet they got some real cool turtles.
I don't know about the turtles, but I wanted to talk about two of the creatures that are endemic to Lake Baikal.
Hell yeah.
One is a pink, semi-transparent fish called a golemyanka, which gives birth to live young.
Whoa, that's wild for a fish.
Right?
That's a little freaky fish.
And a mammal of note, which once I tell you the name of this mammal of note, I would love for you to search them up real quick so you can see just how cute.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Is the Baikal seal.
Baikal seal.
A.K.A.
Oh.
Right? A.K.A. Nerpa. The Baikal Nerpa.
They all look like they're about to cry.
They do with their big wet eyes.
They got big old wet eyes and they're so round and fluffy.
They look so good. They do kind of have like the same vibe as like, I'm a little pit bull that lives in the water.
Yeah. Oh, I love them. They're delightful.
So coincidentally, the Baikal seal loves eating the golemyanka.
That's rough for the golemyanka.
Baikal seals Yeah, especially because Baikal seals eat more than half of the annually produced biomass of Golem Yonka each year.
Wow.
So more than half of them that are live birthed each year.
That's wild.
Just get ate by these seals.
But they're so cute.
They're so cute. They gotta eat. They eat the weirfish.
And they gotta be chubby.
They're so good.
Oh my god. I just found the most amazing picture. This straight up looks like a picture of Falchio. Like, if I was squinting and you showed me this picture, I'd be like, oh, that's Falchio.
That's my son.
Look at that.
So good. They got the biggest wet eyes. They are one of the smallest seals. They are the only freshwater pinniped species.
I love them. They're so small.
So I don't know if you're familiar. Pinnipeds are like seals, sea lions, that family of sea puppies.
Gotcha.
So they're related to the Caspian seal, which is endemic to the Caspian Sea, which is another large inland body of water. And there are a couple other types of seals that also do live in freshwater, but they also live in the sea, like the ocean and salt water. So these are the only ones who don't live in both and strictly live in freshwater. So how the fuck did the seals get there? Has been a big question for people who are studying Lake Baikal.
That's a good question.
Like, it is so far inland. How the fuck? There's not.
How'd they get them seals there? There has to have been, like, many millennia ago, back before the continents merged. There has to have been some connection to the greater ocean, right?
Experts say that they think at some point the seals may have swum up rivers and streams. Or the theory that I think sounds like it's more likely, that Baikal may have been linked to the ocean through a larger body of water formed in a previous ice age. And those seals became trapped when the temperature shifted, cutting them off from the ocean again.
Oh, wow. That's wild. Yeah, I bet that's a good theory. My best theory that I had was that somebody brought one in their pocket and said, be free, my baby, I love you.
Be free, my babies.
Go eat some pink fish.
Lake Baikal is 25 million years old, and these seals have only been there for 2 million years, thereabouts. But it is a very old flavor of seal.
That's really cool. They're fucking adorable.
They're and really I love cute. Them.
They're so cute. It's like they're like a regular seal if you deliberately made them cuter, like selectively bred them to be more adorable.
And smaller. They're like smaller, pretty fucking small.
Cuter. Big wet eyes, extra fuzzy. I love it.
So
somebody really cooked with these seals.
So there is also a picture I will share with you. So I think the name in Russian is Nerpa, and there is a Nerpa festival in a town. I'm going to butcher this if you speak Russian. I'm so sorry. Irkutsk. But this is the Baikal seal mascot at the Nerpa festival. It's a big silly seal. Yeah, it's a big, silly like seal. Inflatable seal mascot.
That's but, yeah, real good.
I heard about these seals and I'm probably going to do... I think I will end up doing some more stuff about Lake Baikal because it is so interesting. There's like
that's
so much
cool
to talk about. That's why I just, that's why I was like, listen, these seals got to have their time to shine. And that's the one thing I know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good job. Honestly. Like, great topic. I love it. I love the little babies. I love the big lake. It's very
good. Big wet eyes.
Big wet eyes. Big wet hole. Not on the seals. In the water. In the ground. In the earth in Siberia.
You're talking
big
about
wet hole.
Big wet hole. Okay.
Just, I'm saying your topic was about one big wet hole that has a bunch of little seals with big wet eyes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Not, I'm not saying the seals have a big wet hole. That's gross. That's
I just heard
that's
big
not
wet,
what I'm saying.
I just heard big wet hole, and I'm like, Violet, we are recording a podcast episode.
Sorry, I just had to talk about my big wet hole for a second.
So what do you got for me? What's your final topic?
My final topic is something that feels kind of like magic, and I went on a rabbit hole trying to understand how it's not magic. And I think I understand, but it still feels like magic. And it's
magic is just science we don't understand yet, you know?
Exactly, right. And that's how I live my life. And I try to become a wizard, in a sense, of knowledge.
A lot of science is magic to me because my comprehension of it is quite limited.
That is the tragedy of a knowledge wizard, is that as you understand things more, you become less and less magical.
I don't know, but the more you try to learn, the more you're like, hey, how the hell did those seals get there, though?
So I want to talk about piezoelectricity, or I think in the UK they call it piezoelectricity, but
I need
in
to see
the US,
how this is spelled.
P-I-E-Z-O electricity. Piezo electricity.
It looked like piezo.
Well, nobody says it like that.
Well, I just did. Jot that down.
Jot that down.
I just did.
Piezoelectricity is the ability of certain materials, such as magical crystals, not magical really, but crystals, and some ceramics, to generate an electric charge when subjected to mechanical stress. You squeeze rock, it make electricity.
Like quartz in watches?
Exactly like quartz in watches. Okay. Right on the money.
Okay.
You win a car.
I don't want that, but thank you.
That's fair. Yeah, I'll keep the car then. So piezoelectricity was discovered by the husband of Marie Curie, Pierre Curie, and his brother Jacques Curie in 1880.
They just said, give me the French names everyone assumes are just the basic French names. Marie, Pierre, and Jacques. Those are the first three I will pull out of my butt. That is kind of funny.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's just
honestly,
like
the most stereotypical French ass names.
Mary, Peter, and Jack. Like just.
Yeah. The piezoelectric effect, or piezoelectricity, is related to the pyroelectric effect in a way. Pyroelectricity is a whole other thing where heating or cooling a mineral, changing its temperature, generates electricity. But that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm talking about piezoelectricity, which I feel like is more magical, right? Because you're just putting stress on a crystal and it's going, electricity. Quartz, for example, if you cut it in a very particular way, you can generate electricity by putting mechanical stress on it. The way this works is the atoms of the crystal are arranged in a fixed lattice. So imagine like a chain link fence, right? You know how it's like the hexagon shape? Imagine at each of the intersections between of those chains, there's a molecule, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you go around one of those little hexagons and alternate between one molecule, the other molecule, one molecule, the other molecule, one of those molecules is positively charged. The other molecule is negatively charged. So you've got a hexagon, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative. Now, if you squeeze that hexagon, the way that the positive, if you squeeze it one way, the positive molecules will move. They won't shift. They're not symmetrical around a point. So it shifts in one way when you squeeze it, right? Imagine if you squeeze a sandwich and like the fillings come out the sides. It's kind of like that. Except because this is an asymmetrical sandwich we're talking about, the fillings are only coming out one side. However, if you squeeze it the other way, the fillings
like,
come out the
like
other way.
Like trying to eat a sloppy taco and everything's falling out the butt.
Kind of, yeah. When this particular stress is put on these crystals in a particular way, the positive molecules go one way, the negative molecules go another way, and you end up where the surface charge on one side is positive and the surface charge on the other side is negative. Think of a battery. You've got a positive terminal and a negative terminal. Same thing. It only happens for a moment before the charge dissipates, right? It's just like a moment of instantaneous energy, but it's there. It happens. That's how it generates this electricity. It's really interesting. And you have to have a non-centrosymmetric crystal, those without a center single point of symmetry, and it has to not basically cancel each other out. So normally when you squeeze something, it's symmetric. So any movement of the positive and negative ions, it all evens out. not the case with this. So you have to have a very, very particular set of molecules with particular polarities in a particular arrangement. It's not very common. There's only a handful of things that actually do this, but quartz, again, is perhaps the most common one. Now, the interesting thing is that the piezoelectric effect is bidirectional. So that means when you squeeze crystal, it generates electricity. But when you put electricity into crystal, it squeezes.
Oh, that's fun.
Right? Yeah. So it vibrates. It moves. If you take a piezoelectric crystal and you put an electrical signal into it, like an audio signal, for example, you can put it up to your ear and hear it. It makes noise. It's a speaker.
Whoa. I want to get rid of our JBL. We're only going to use a massive hunk of quartz now.
Right. Well, the thing is, a massive hunk of quartz wouldn't work. It would have to be a very tiny, basically a tuning fork of quartz. Literally a tuning fork of quartz.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, a little tiny tuning fork made of quartz. Literally, that is what watches use, is a tiny tuning fork of quartz. So it's wild. Think of like a barbecue lighter. You know those lighters where you mm-hmm. like click it? That clicking is a spring actuating a little hammer that's hitting a crystal. And the crystal is generating electricity up. To make a spark. Yes, for real.
That's a wizard wand.
Your little click. It's a wizard wand. That's You're a using a magic crystal to light a fire.
A
it's a wizard wand. It's crazy, right?
That's Sorry, a fucking wizard wand. I think I clipped there.
But it's so cool. You see what I mean? How it feels like magic even when you kind of know how it works?
That's a wizard wand.
It's a wizard wand. So piezoelectricity can be used for, and to be clear, you can make a speaker with a piezoelectric crystal. It doesn't sound good. There's better ways to do it, but it can do that, right?
So don't get rid of our JBL speakers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, don't get rid of the JBL. Also, you can, because like mechanical stress, right? It works both ways. You can speak into that same crystal that you use to generate the sound, and it will generate an electrical signal. So every microphone is a speaker. Every speaker is a microphone. If you just invert how it's, whether it's receiving or putting
So they're
out,
stones
right?
of far speech.
Basically.
Incredible.
You can also use them because they can vibrate at super high frequencies and stuff. You can use them for ultrasound transducers. So you remember when we went to the hardware store a while back and I was like, I want an ultrasonic transducer to interrupt radio signals.
Yeah.
I was looking for something with a big old piece of quartz in there.
And I was just like, have a blast, my darling. I'm going to go fiddle around over here.
Yeah. I was like, I seek the magic crystal that will interrupt the radio signals.
And then you said that. And then you said that the dude at the front goes, ah, wizard yourself. I, too, dabble in the arts. And then you discussed your transducers.
Yeah. Transducers.
These douchers are trans. Yeah, no, I remember because I was like, these douchers are trans.
But you can also use the piezoelectric effect for vibration sensors, accelerometers, energy harvesters that generate voltage from physical movement, things like that. Crystal watches, of course. Quartz is a piezoelectric crystal used in watch oscillators. They basically take a tiny little tuning fork made of quartz. And they will make it in a particular size, and then they calibrate it. They calibrate it to vibrate specifically at 32,768 vibrations per second. And that is because 32,768 is 2 to the power of 15, which allow digital circuits, this is oversimplified, to divide it down to 1 hertz or 1 tick per second. And the way they do this, by the way, the way they get it to this exact frequency is really cool. They make this little tuning fork, and if it vibrates a little too fast, they put some gold on the tips of the tuning forks to slow it down a little bit, just to give it some additional mass. And then if it's too slow, they shave a little bit off of the tuning forks to make it go a little bit faster.
That calibrating would be so stressful. I'd end up with a nub of a tuning fork going, I had to shave too much. It's half gold.
Oh, no.
What have I done?
No, that's okay. They have like a computer probably that does it. And so these piezoelectric crystals, they have a lot of interesting uses, but they're also kind of limited because it's only making a brief high voltage pulse, and the voltage depends on the force, the speed, and the stiffness of the material that's striking it. So they are strong enough to like make a spark, but they don't really deliver much current. There's not much force behind it. So they're great for like sending signals, lighting a barbecue, but not actual like power. Good for a little short burst of energy. They're not really suitable for like continuous power generation or anything like that, but they're great for like self-powered sensors and micro devices and all sorts of really, really cool things. The most common piezoelectric materials are quartz, tourmaline, and Rochelle salt, which I don't really know what that is.
Like a drag queen.
It sounds like a drag queen or a drug.
I'm Rochelle.
You got any of that Rochelle salt?
I'm Rochelle salt.
Right, yeah. There's also synthetic materials. There's one called PZT, also known as lead zirconate titanate, which actually has stronger than natural materials piezoelectric properties. I just thought it was so neat. It's just such a cool little like scientific effect that it feels like magic.
I'm Paizo, the watch wizard.
Paizo, the watch wizard.
I'm Paizo, the watch wizard.
What's that phrase that's like an alternative to, you know those phrases that are like, it includes every letter of the alphabet? I think it's like the Sphinx of Black Quartz.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, yeah. So there's the something fox
the quick
jumped
brown
over the lazy
fox,
dog.
The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog.
Yeah, there's another one that I think is much, much cooler. Yeah. Sphinx of Black Quartz, judge my vow.
Jesus Christ. That right? sounds like lyrics in a King Gizzard song.
Honestly, yeah. It's a sick phrase. I like that one way better. Sphinx of Black Quartz, judge my vow. But yeah, I honestly, if you had a Sphinx of Black Quartz and you squoze it, it might have some electricity.
Hey friends, before I thank our Patreon supporters, I would like to point you to a mutual aid opportunity that you can find in our show details. In the show details, you'll find a link to both the Instagram page for the Funds for Wadi raffle and the Chuffed campaign for Wadi, who is a young Palestinian man living in a tent with his 7 family members. And the goal right now is to get Wadi a new tent for his family. They all share this tent. Food has been hard to come by, and any monetary support you can give will tangibly affect the life of this young man and his 7 family members. So if you're in a place to donate, you can go to our show details, find a link to Wadi's Chuffed campaign and also the Funds for Wadi Instagram account, where they regularly hold raffles that raise money for Wadi and his family. And now I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, like Anarchista, Bethany Glass, Carl Brooks, Chamberlain Foreman, Fintago, Dave Perrell, Gus, Helen Clifford, Janice Weston, Kate Genius, Kate Mishagoose, Laura Kramer, Lilith Rain, Lutzi, Megan E., Natasha Neves, Nunya B., Percy, Rachel Rachelson, Randy Lovings, and Sewing Seraph. Now, you know the usual. If you want to help us out, you can tell other people about the show. We don't take paid ads. We don't pay for advertising. So word of mouth is entirely how we grow. So if there is a place online that you feel, you know, someone might appreciate info dumpies, share it. You know, Discord server, Reddit, wherever you happen to be lurking on the internet. That helps us out a ton. You can also subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. This lets the algorithms know that people care about the show. It helps us in the rankings, which gets us more attention by the algorithms. You can leave a cute rating and review. Any positive interaction you can do with our shows on the interwebs helps us out a ton. I would also like to ask you to do this for our upcoming show that we have coming out on November 1st called Murphy Bay Magic. It is the spinoff to today's lucky winner, and it is going to be a starting point for people who maybe don't want to listen to all 90 episodes of today's lucky winner, where you can hop in on that universe while not really missing out on everything. So we kind of tried to make it the angel to our Buffy, if you will. If I may be so bold as to make that comparison. So any traction shows get in the early days really helps. We have a trailer up right now, and if you go ahead and subscribe to that now, that would help us out a ton. Now, back to info dumpies, though. If you're in a place to support us monetarily, which actually this also would help Murphy Bay Magic, you can find a link to our Patreon in our show details. Patreon has rewards for everything we do as a group at Mixnomer. As long as we're able to make shows, there will be bonus material for any shows that we make, and we're going to keep making shows. So go follow the, go support us on Patreon if you are so inclined and have the resources to do so. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.